My name is David Wee. I live in Northfield, Minnesota, where I'm an English professor at St. Olaf College and have been doing that for 14 years. And some of the other things that I've been doing besides teaching have been involved with academic administration. For 2 years, I was the assistant academic dean at St. Olaf, so I was involved with the administrative end of the academic program of the college. And then for the last 3 years, I've been the administrator of St. Olaf's alternative college within the college called the Paracollege. And it's related to this that I'm going to make some comments about education. I heard comments this morning about what a strange night it was. The people were up in the middle of the night chasing bears, and that others, including our 10-year-old daughter, were out trying to view the lunar eclipse, which was eclipsed more by Copper Peak than it was by the rest of the Earth. But I wasn't up and around, but I had a fitful night too, maybe because of those things. And primarily it was a dream. I dreamed that I had died, and that I had arrived at the pearly gates and greeted St. Peter and said, "Here I am, let me in." And he said, "Well, there's one problem, you can't get in because the pearly gates aren't actually right here." He pointed off to a ladder reaching off into the clouds and said, "The pearly gates are at the top of that ladder. And the way to get to the pearly gates is to climb the ladder. The only thing is that you have to take along some chalk, and every sin you've committed, you have to write out on a rung of that ladder, one sin per rung. And when you've written out all of your sins, you'll be at the top of the ladder and at the pearly gates." So I took a bucket of chalk and went off to the... base of the ladder and started writing my sins out. And days later, I was high in the clouds, writing away with the chalk, when I felt something hard and heavy on my hand, and I looked up, and here was John Schramm coming down for more chalk. Well, two days ago was the day after Labor Day. And that's the traditional day in our country for the start of another year of school. And like many American families, Karen and I went through the usual ritual of seeing that our children were well-dressed and scrubbed and had notebook and pencils, and took their picture in front of the house, or in front of the chalet in this case, as they headed off to the first day of school. That occurrence, plus some of the things that have been said at Vespers and devotions during the last few days, especially about the concept of community and human relationships and the value and nature of individuals, got me to thinking about education. And then a few nights ago, those of us who were here then were able to see a film about the life of C.S. Lewis. And part of that film chronicled his early years and his education and showed the pictures of the schools which he had attended early in his life and talked about the dismal experience in education that he had until he was turned over to a tutor, a retired professor who took him under his wing and helped him continue his education and really brought him out of the horrible educational situation that he'd had. So it seemed to me that this is a good time for us to talk and think a little bit about education, especially in America. Some of us here are teachers or have been teachers or will be teachers. All of us have had some formal education, and others of us are going to have some more, and others are engaging in various types of informal education. Many of us have children or grandchildren for whom we cherish a good education. And all of us spend parts of our days and our working situations with people who've had some kind of education. And therefore, we all have an investment in education, in good education, in what its possibilities are, what its practices are. And I hope that after I spend some time talking, that then we can share some things about what's good and what's not so good about education, especially in this country, and especially because I'm in that area, about college education. Now, here at Holden, I realize that I may be talking with the redeemed. I've seen some of the educational things that go on here, and they're marvelous. And I've already, in this first week of school, have seen some of the things that are happening with my children, who are in the fifth grade and the eighth grade. And I'm very much excited by the kind of educational process that's happening here. But we all have something to do with education at other places as well. And I think we need to talk about what it is like and what it could be like. Do any of you know the real Latin root meaning of education? Any Latin scholars here? That's right. Comes from the Latin word which means to lead out or to draw out. And when you think that is the what education is supposed to do, to lead out or draw out of an individual the potential, one gets stunned to look at what education you and I have had and the traditional kinds of education. And I think we recognize that very much of education seems to be more pouring in than leading out or drawing out. And it made me think about Charles Dickens' novel Hard Times. My special field of scholarship is Victorian literature, so those of you who listen to me several times have to hear me talking about the Victorians on occasion. This book by Dickens, written well over a century ago, has as one of its topics, but not the main one, but one of its topics, education. And I want to read to you the very first paragraph, and then a few other paragraphs at the beginning of the novel, and ask you to think about what's happening in education. First paragraph is all quotation, and it's from the words of somebody speaking to school children in England, a school very much like the one I suspect C.S. Lewis endured. The title of the chapter is The One Thing Needful. Now what I want is facts. Teach these boys and girls nothing but facts. Facts alone are wanted in life. Plant nothing else and root out everything else. You can only form the minds of reasoning animals upon facts. Nothing else will ever be of any service to them. This is the principle on which I bring up my own children, and this is the principle on which I bring up these children. Stick to facts. Now that's the very beginning of this novel. And then the last paragraph of this opening chapter, even shorter than that one, reads this way. The speaker and the schoolmaster and the third grown person present, there's a kind of school examiner present in this classroom, all backed a little and swept with their eyes the inclined plane of little vessels then and there arranged in order, ready to have imperial gallons of facts poured into them until they were full to the brim. Now that was Dickens' image of the kind of education that he saw happening at England, that instead of concept of drawing out of human beings their potential and abilities and leading them out of ignorance into wisdom, it is an image of students as empty little vessels waiting to have facts poured into them, just the opposite of what education really ought to be. And then, and this chapter is the last one I'm going to quote from this novel, the second chapter is entitled Murdering the Innocents, which is a good description of what is happening in the education that Dickens is criticizing here. In this chapter, one of the students is referred to as girl number 20. And I was reminded of this immediately when the first Vespers I heard when I arrived at Holden last Saturday used as its scriptural passages two passages in which God was naming names instead of calling people by number or by collective group. The whole point of that Vesper service was that God cared about individuals as people, not with names. And here it's girl number 20. And girl number 20 is asked to give a definition of a horse. And she's thrown into great alarm and unable to do it. Girl number 20, unable to define a horse, said Mr. Gradgrind, for the general behoof of all the little pitchers. He said those empty, upturned pitchers. Girl number 20, possessed of no facts in reference to one of the commonest animals. Some boy's definition of a horse. Bitzer, yours. So he calls on another student. And here's his definition of a horse. Quadruped, graminivorous, 40 teeth, namely 24 grinders, 4 eye teeth, and 12 incisive. Sheds coat in the spring. In marshy countries, sheds hooves, too. Hoofs hard, but requiring to be shod with iron. Age known by marks in mouth. Now, girl number 20, you know what a horse is. That's a horrible parody. It's an exaggeration, of course, but based upon some real experience of what education it can be when it's the opposite of drawing out and instead it's pouring in. The words that are repeated over and over again throughout this novel by Dickens is the words fancy and wonder. Whenever a child in the story says, well, I fancy or I wonder if, the adults immediately slap them down and say, never fancy, never wonder, only facts. Thus the imagination, you see, and intellectual curiosity are to be stifled and repressed in favor of facts, which are, as the title says, the one thing needful. Even the teacher in the novel is named McChokum Child. Dickens liked to use absurd but very descriptive names. Well, I titled this talk, And Down They Forgot As Up They Grew, which is a line from a poem that we talked about 2 days ago, a poem by E.E. Cummings called Anyone Lived in a Pretty How Town. And part of that poem is to point out how children forget certain intuitive wisdoms and understandings about human relationships as they grow up. And part of the growing up is also a forgetting down, a kind of downward movement spiritually and emotionally as one learns to be adult and rational and acculturated. So if in education at its worst, children are taught or encouraged to forget how to wonder, to forget how to fancy, how to use the imagination, and instead are asked to be pitchers, empty pitchers into which facts are poured, we ought to have a great concern about education. Well, how can this happen? Or what is it about education, as you and I have experienced it, that fails to draw out our full potential? Well, what I'd like to do is have us look at what is the typical college education in America.
I have to think back. This is a long time ago.
We had good memory on the first one.
Yeah.
It comes from the Latin root that means to read. And that's really what a lecture is. It's simply a reading. And in some senses, it's simply a pouring out of the instructor's ideas or words into those empty vessels in inclined rows of the classroom. Another characteristic is that progress toward a degree is based on accumulation of credits and courses or semester hours or quarter hours, a kind of quantitative accumulation of units of study until you've got enough of them and then you get a degree and are graduated. It's characterized by classes that students learn in fairly large groups of classes, maybe 15 or 35 or 100 or even 500 or 1,000 students in some large university classes, all learning at once from one person. It's characterized by grades, by that kind of numerical or alphabetical analysis of the quality of the student's work, and then the competition that results from it. Students in most grading systems are ranked. Your grade point average is higher than your roommate's grade point average, and it's all relative, so that you are ranked and you know where you stand. You know whether you're 10th in your class or 500th, and that creates a sense of competition. And then it's characterized by having to have a major, a field in which you specialize, and then usually a set of other graduation requirements. In most colleges, graduation requirements are designed to ensure that the student has a kind of broadness in the education, that all of one study can't be in your favorite field, that you have to learn something in the sciences and in the arts and humanities. And with those graduation requirements, what most students choose to do is get them out of the way. That's the language students always use. Get the requirements out of the way as soon as possible so you can work on the fun stuff. Well, 10 or 12 years ago at St. Olaf, we decided that we would create an experimental college, that we would establish a college within the college with a certain amount of autonomy where we would try some experiment with education. And the administration assigned three faculty, and I was one of those three, the job of creating whatever educational experiment we could think of, as long as it were an experimental college. And that was one of the most exciting things, I think, that any faculty members, any teachers could have, the chance to start with a clean slate and create any kind of educational system that we thought was legitimate and would work. And our only stipulation was that the general goals of this education had to be the same as the general goals of St. Olaf College. In other words, we couldn't create an engineering school because St. Olaf was a liberal arts college. But that was the only thing that was that limited us. Well, the three of us spent all day every day for a month one summer talking and reading and arguing and sometimes yelling at each other a little bit, trying to decide what kind of college we would create and what requirements it would have and what educational philosophy it would have that the whole St. Olaf faculty would approve. You do have to have some political considerations when you create something that has to be approved by somebody else. You can only be as bold as you think someone else will approve. This was in the summer of 1968. And at the end of that summer, we presented this proposal for an experimental college, and the faculty debated it for several months and finally adopted it. And in the fall of 1969, just 10 years ago this week, the para-college at St. Olaf began. And I want to tell you what the basic educational philosophy of this program is. And then perhaps we can discuss how this sort of a thing works or might work in other educational settings. The first thing that we agreed upon was that every student should have more flexibility in determining whatever strategy for learning seemed right to the student and to that student's faculty advisors. And in order to achieve this greater flexibility, we did several things. One is we asked the student to design her own major. That is, the usual college system is that sometime in the distant past, the English department or the biology department decided what every English major or biology major had to take in order to be a major. And you simply open the catalog to the right page, and that tells you what courses you have to take. Well, we decided that the world isn't organized as neatly as that, and that many students had interests that didn't fall into those neat departmental categories. And that students should have the flexibility to design a major that was exactly what they wanted to do, and not just approximately, as most departmental requirements are. So we ask students to design their majors to be what they really wanted to do, not just what the English department said they had to do. We decided that we would not offer credits for what students did. And it's remarkable how that frees up education for experiment, when you don't have to attach semester hours or course credits to every piece of learning that you do. We thought that that's a kind of a false quantification of learning, and that we'd come up with some other means to find out when students had learned enough to graduate. So we threw out the window the whole system of academic accounting, and we don't give students course credits for what they do in the paracollege. They're learning all the time, but at the end of the semester they don't have 4 credits or 16 semester hours. They just have one more semester of, we hope, good learning. And then we believe that students should work at their own pace. We agreed that the American system is an efficient educational system in the sense that it educates lots of people in a fairly economic way, because you have a classroom of 30 students. You ask them all to do the same thing at the same time. They all start in the day after Labor Day, and they all quit a week before Christmas, and they all accomplish the same things at the same pace. We thought that didn't make sense, that individuals are unique, and that some people take longer to learn something, and that somehow we should have a system that would allow some students to work faster and others to work slower, and that for some it would take more than 4 years to graduate from college, and for others it would take less. So those are some of the flexibilities we created. A second basic educational philosophy that we held was that we should try to develop a sense of cooperation among students rather than competition. Because we have sensed, those of us who teach a lot in college, realize how desperate and depressed students get in the whole race for grades and grade point averages, and how depressing it is to see other students getting better grades, and therefore you're going to lose your scholarship or flunk out, so forth. So we tried to come up with some ways to develop a sense of community and of cooperation amongst learners instead of competition. One way we did it was to do away with almost all grades. In the paracollege, almost nothing is given those letter grades. We do lots of evaluation. That is, we as faculty write paragraphs to evaluate the work that a student has done, and we send those paragraphs to the student and to the parents. But we've discovered that especially parents get quite uneasy when at the end of a semester they'll get several pages of narrative evaluation of a student, but there isn't a B+ or an A- or a 3.43 grade point average, because we've become so accustomed to that we sense that has my child learned anything if he doesn't have a grade and a grade point average? But we believe that we can provide much more specific and careful evaluation with a paragraph of writing than with a single letter of the alphabet. So our students don't have grades, so they don't have grade point averages, so they aren't ranked with each other, and there's no sense of having to get a better grade point average than the next person. Another thing we did was to add a requirement that all students had to do some teaching before they could graduate. And we did this because we believed, one, that one of the best ways to learn a thing well is to be asked to teach it to somebody else. Those of us who are teachers have all learned that. Secondly, that it would foster this sense of cooperation. You're helping your fellow student learn something that you know a little better than she does and can help with it. And the other thing is that we thought it would help everyone think more about the process of learning and of teaching if they were asked to do some teaching before they graduate. A third basic educational philosophy was that we should try to promote individual and small group learning rather than learning in a class of 30 or 50 or 100. And we did this in several ways. Our basic mode of teaching and learning in the Paracollege is the tutorial. And that is where every class is a one-student class. The student comes in, as some of us saw in the C.S. Lewis film, the student comes in once a week and spends an hour with the faculty member, and you're the only student there. And I have yet to see a student who falls asleep in a tutorial or writes letters home, as students often do in the back row of large lecture halls. In a tutorial, you are nose to nose with your instructor. And it's a far better way, we believe, in drawing out the abilities of a student and helping them develop than the lecture method of reading and pouring into empty vessels. And one thing that many of us have learned about lecturing is the old definition that a lecture is the process whereby information is transferred from the mind of the professor into the notes, from the notes of the professor to the notes of the students without passing through the mind of either. And often that's what does happen. We also offer in the Paracollege lots of small seminars and workshops. We not only use the tutorial as a teaching method, but groups of 4, 5, 6 students at a time. All of my teaching in the last 3 years in the Paracollege, I've done in my own office. I've never had more than 5 students at a time. It's a marvelous thing for a teacher, and it's about the best deal that a student can get anywhere I know of, to have that close access to faculty. Another element of our educational philosophy is interdisciplinary work. Again, we believe that learning and wisdom about the world is not divided neatly into biology and chemistry and history and English, but that most things we come to know are interdisciplinary and interconnected. So we do much teaching together. In the Paracollege, much of our teaching is done by 2 or 3 faculty members together. Sometimes the faculty almost outnumber the students in a small workshop. And we get faculty from different fields teaching together. It's a great way for faculty to become broader, and it helps students integrate the different elements of learning. Most of the students' majors are interdisciplinary. There are very few students in the Paracollege who create a major that's called biology or English. It's usually a major in biomedical ethics, where you combine philosophy and theology and biology and chemistry, perhaps. Or we have students majoring in the Renaissance. I want to be a history major, but they're fascinated by the Renaissance and study the history and the literature and the art and the sociology and the politics of the Renaissance, rather than simply having to be a history major. And then our examinations are interdisciplinary. Almost all the examinations, and I'll describe them in a moment, require the students not simply to spout back those facts which we have read and poured into them, but ask them to reveal their ability to relate different fields in an interdisciplinary way. 2 more basic elements of our educational philosophy. One is that each student should have a greater responsibility for her own educational destiny and for the governance of the educational institution in which she's studying. So we've asked the students to plan their major. Every semester, each of us who is a tutor sits down with each of the students for whom we're responsible, and we say, all right, what are you going to study this semester? What are your educational goals for this semester and beyond? What will be the best way for you to pursue those goals? Let's work out a program for you. And the student has to have a rationale for choosing the things that she chooses to study. And then the committees in the para-college all have almost equal enrollments of faculty and students. We have a committee that governs educational policy, another one that governs the community life, and another that discusses academic, special academic petitions. And there's only one more faculty member than students on each of these committees, so that they all have full voting rights and have almost as much authority in these as the faculty. And then finally, we believe in experimentation. That is, we think we ought always to be trying new things. The para-college itself, in this kind of tutorial system, was and still is a kind of experiment for us, although we've really discovered that the experiment does work at St. Olaf with the faculty we have and the students we have. So, in a sense, that experiment is finished, but we keep trying to experiment with every new seminar and workshop and tutorial that we offer, and we do a lot of experimenting with the kind of exams that we write. Now, how has this worked? Well, right now the para-college has about 170 students. St. Olaf itself has 3,000 undergraduates, so only about 6 or 7% of the students choose to be in this program. It has 25 faculty members. The enrollment has been higher, and then it dropped a bit, and now it's going back up again. We have had majors in virtually every field that the St. Olaf faculty is able to work with. Just a fascinating variety of majors in the sciences and the arts and humanities. And they have gone on to do remarkable things. One of the things that people always ask us about para-colleges, what in the world happens after they graduate? Can they get jobs? Can they get into medical school or law school?
Or get a job. An employer that throws out all applications that are below 3.5.
Right. Well, we aren't the only experimental college in the country that has a kind of narrative evaluation. So employers and medical schools have had to make some adjustments to their admissions procedures when they get a transcript that has words instead of 3.50 on it. Our graduates of the para-college get a BA degree from St. Olaf, so their degree is the same degree as any other graduate of the college, so that whatever prestige or weight that carries with people, it carries for the para-college student as well, because in a sense, the whole St. Olaf faculty has vouched for these people, even though they've done their work in this alternate program. We've done some checks of comparing the regular St. Olaf graduates with the para-college graduates, and have found that almost the identical percentage from both groups go on to graduate school and professional school. Every year, without exception, we've had our graduates accepted into medical school. So, now our first graduates were 7 years ago, and a few years ago they began to graduate from medical school, so we have three or four physicians now who are para-college alumni. We have several PhDs who are back teaching at St. Olaf and in the para-college. We have half a dozen lawyers, including the first woman lawyer in a major law firm in Minneapolis. And then we discovered an amazing thing one year. We found out that 12% of the regular St. Olaf graduates took jobs in business and industry that year, and 35% of the Paracollege graduates got jobs in business and industry. Three times the rate of employment than the regular college students had. And this we didn't understand, because as you might guess, the students in this program are not very practically oriented. They go into this because of its possibilities for learning, not because it's the direct and traditional way to job X. So what we found out when we inquired of these employers and of the students was that in job interviews, the Paracollege students were extremely poised. Their main way of studying for 4 years had been sitting down one-to-one in a room with an authority figure, being quizzed by that authority figure, and by the time they're seniors, they're quite poised in a job interview. Whereas most college seniors, when they go through those first job interviews, it's the first time they've ever had such a thing, and they're terrified. And this was a kind of a side benefit that we hadn't anticipated at all. The other thing is that we require of all students in this program to do a major project in their field, which we call the senior project. And it's similar to a kind of honors thesis that some colleges require of their honors students, but we require it of every one of our students. So some of them aren't all brilliant, but they all have to do a kind of a year-long major extended project in their field. And when an employer is interviewing for prospective employees, one of the things that employer wants is someone who has somehow demonstrated the ability to take an assignment, a project, and carry it out with a minimum of supervision and hand-holding. And all of our graduates have demonstrated that in their senior project and in some of the other relatively independent work that they've done. So while we hadn't planned it this way and certainly didn't anticipate it, we found that our students get into graduate and professional schools just as easily as the rest of St. Olaf graduates, who have a very good record. And in some years they've gotten jobs at a much higher rate than the regular graduates, and we think that these were some of the reasons for it. Well, I'll say one other thing, and then we'll have about 10 or 12 minutes for talk before Vespers. What you might have wondered is, how in the world do we examine students? What kind of examinations would we give to students who are doing these vastly different things which don't carry credits and don't earn grades? Well, we have comprehensive exams. Every student takes a comprehensive, a major exam in one's major field, and then in what you call general studies or liberal arts, the kind of thing that's covered by distribution requirements at most colleges. And these examinations have to be designed in such a way that the student is not asked to spout back the facts that she learned in a certain course. Because of 20 students taking this exam, we know that they've pursued their studies in 20 different ways. So the exams have to ask questions that students can answer by using the learning and the studies that they have chosen to do. And that's been an interesting thing for the faculty, to design exams for students who have not listened to our lectures and have not read the textbooks that we might have assigned, but who have done other things. And then the students take a major comprehensive exam in their major field. And that includes usually three or four written sections where they write for 6 or 8 hours on each section, or take a 24-hour or 48-hour take-home exam on various topics within their major field. And then it finishes with a 1 or 2 hour oral exam with a panel of three or four professors asking questions of the one student. And we've been amazed at how poised our students are in that kind of situation. So basically, when our students have passed both of these exams, which each exam takes anywhere from a week to a couple of months from beginning to end, because it's in several sections, when they pass those exams and have fulfilled some of the other requirements, like our teaching requirement, we grant them the BA from St. Olaf. or whether it's taken them 2 years or 3.5 or 5 to graduate. And we think it's a good system, and that the educational philosophy on which it's based makes far more sense than the kind of education that I had and that perhaps many of you had at various stages of your careers. Well, do you have any other questions or observations about this kind of program?
Yeah. I know the educational philosophy today is not to give so much credit to facts.
Mm-hmm.
I want to raise this point from my own experience. Facts, I think, are necessary in the first place. And tied in well, facts, to me, create wonder. If I learn something about facts, it creates wonder. I'm wondering if much of this that you talk about, drawing out, leaving out, doesn't have to come from within. And I guess I can't drop totally facts, but we've got to, people must be exposed to facts. They must learn something.
Sure.
And then these facts create wonder within the individual. Now, what the individual does with that is another matter. And much of this we cannot teach. Much of this must be from within. It must be part of the whole person's personality. It must be part of the background from within the home, curiosity, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'd like to correct one misimpression then. The thing I read from Dickens, you remember the title of the chapter was The One Thing Needful, and the speaker said the only thing you need is facts. Now, by contrasting that, I'm not suggesting that you don't need facts at all and that facts should be ignored. All of us who teach work with facts very much. But one thing we do recognize is that the facts that I might teach today may not be the facts that are important for my students 20 years from now. And that what we all need to do as individuals is develop the ability to find out the information or the facts that we need to know for the situation in which we live. And an older view of education sometimes suggested, as in the Dickens quotation, that if you know certain facts about the dates of this war and the names of those generals and so forth, that was all you needed in order to be a full human being. I think that our philosophy is that we're always teaching facts, but we haven't said that's the one needful thing. We're saying that there are two or three or four or other very important needful things, such as imagination, wonder, curiosity, adaptability, flexibility, imagination. Those are things that the Dickens teacher would have rejected, but which we believe have to be included with the facts. We're always teaching facts and asking our students to use facts, but we don't limit it to facts. So I hope I didn't give
you didn't impression. Give that impression, but I just wanted to emphasize the other side a little bit, because the individual student must be something more in him than just everything being done for him.
That's right. And that's one of the great joys of education, and one of its mysteries is how to stimulate and inspire the individuals to care enough to have that inner drive to pursue education.
Facts themselves can do that too.
What criteria do you utilize to allow someone to come into this program?
The only requirements are that they be a St. Olaf student, that is, they have to be accepted to St. Olaf College.
First,
that's right. And then all they have to do is apply. We accept everybody who applies. So we're not an honors program. See, we thought that we wanted to come up with a system that would work as well with mediocre students as it would with honor students. Because the honor students get along just fine, usually, wherever they are. But we wanted especially to be able to touch those students who aren't even inspired by the facts, you know, who are falling asleep in the back row in the lecture hall.
And you can get information about it directly from St. Olaf, is that correct?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, I was going to send this around while I was talking. There's a booklet here about it. And this I'll make available to people to look at. I'll leave it in here someplace. You and then come to you.
Will the student in this program getting a well-rounded education, or is he just concentrating on the field he's interested in? The reason I ask that is my son went to an engineering college. Mm-hmm. And he got none of the liberal arts. Mm-hmm. And he regrets it very much to this day that he didn't get any of the liberal arts.
Well, we believe that our students are getting a more well-rounded education than the other St. Olaf students because of our emphasis on the interdisciplinary. They have to pass this first major comprehensive exam is in natural science, social science, humanities, and arts, all the fields. They have to demonstrate abilities in all of those. But then in their major field and in their other studies, they also have to be integrating their major field with some other things. So it's very hard for a paracollege student to be a narrow biology major, you know, and not kind of include other fields of study.
I was wondering, is that a four-year course?
Most of them do it in 4 years.
At the university I worked at, they had an experimental college, new college, and they had a select few in there. And they concentrate on one subject at a time instead of taking various subjects at the same time. It was sort of a crash course in one subject at a time. And they got all their credits in 3 years rather than 4 years.
Yeah. There's several colleges that do that. Colorado College has its whole curriculum that way. And a paracollege student could do that. And we've suggested it to some, and no one has ever tried it yet at our program. But sure, that's another good alternative.
It's an experimental thing, too. Yeah. I mean, it was an experiment. Now it's part of the university.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Do you think your program is selective in the sense that it attracts a certain type of student?
Yeah.
And the other question, looking at it in another way, do you think this is an alternative education process for all people who are just an alternative group? You types of interests?
We thought at first that if the paracollege worked, that then maybe the whole college, all of St. Olaf, would adopt the thing. We very quickly found out that only a small percentage, less than 10% of the students, and only about 20% of the faculty wanted anything to do with it. It's real threatening. And it requires too great a shift from the process we've been socialized in.